I'm Marty Moscoe. Welcome to Radio Times. Who would have thought in 1860 that Southern secession would have brought about the end of slavery in the United States? Our guest, Edward Ayers, is a Bancroft-winning author and historian of the Civil War. His new book, The Thin Light of Freedom, is about the final years of that war, fought by two counties in a valley that crossed the Mason-Dixon line between Virginia and Pennsylvania. Ayers' book is based on letters and diaries and news accounts of the time as soldiers and civilians, freed blacks and slaves, struggled to survive the brutal fighting and the aftermath of Reconstruction. We'll talk about that important period of our history and why we still battle over the Civil War, including its symbols, monuments, and flags. Edward Ayers is co-host of the popular podcast Backstory. He's also president of the Organization of American Historians and a professor at the University of Richmond. Ed Ayers, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
Nice to have you with us. This is the second book that you've written about this part of the country, these two counties. Does this represent the complexity, do you think, of the American Civil War?
Yeah, you have to choose your poison when you write about something as big as the Civil War. You can either sort of take a godlike view and cover the whole thing, but not very deeply, or you can get down among the people and know that you can only see what they can see. And that's the choice that I made on this. We have plenty of overviews, but what we don't have are many sort of stories that catch the immediacy of it.
Well, and also catch the fact that these are people essentially living side by side. Yes, there was a Mason-Dixon line, but as far as they were concerned, they lived in this beautiful valley.
Yeah, you know, our usual story is that the Civil War is caused by different economies or soil or climate. But these people live 200 miles apart. There's just a line on the ground that nobody can see, the Mason-Dixon line. And it's the same soil, the same crops, the same ethnicities, the same churches. And somehow, within 6 months, they are persuaded to kill each other. Mm. So it seems more of a puzzle than we seem to let on.
But obviously, for a number of blacks living in the North, they were free, as much as you could be free, I guess, in the North at that time, called contrabands.
Yeah, well, and before the Civil War, if you lived in the Northern County, Franklin County, which is southern boundary is the Mason-Dixon line, any day slave catchers could come across and into the county and claim that you were, in fact, a runaway and drag you into slavery. But you'd also find that there were abolitionists, black and white, who were there arguing for the end of slavery. So it's not that slavery was watered down by being close to the border. In some ways, it was more intense. And during the war, as soon as the war begins, some African Americans go to the Union Army and say, "We're on your side." And so the Union Army says, "We don't really have a law for that, but we'll say you're contraband of war."
That's what the military called that.
That's right. It was a way to actually have people become free, even though the law was not in place for them to become free. And, you know, the White South is really alarmed by this, that within 3 weeks of Virginia seceding, black men are already going to the Union Army and saying, "We're on your side." So slavery's been there for 250 years, but begins to dissolve immediately as soon as there are allies nearby.
How many black soldiers served for the Union or with the Union Army?
Nearly 200,000. So the big story when this book begins, black men are not allowed to fight for the United States for the first 2 years of the war. It's not until the Emancipation Proclamation in January of 63 Abraham Lincoln, at the urging of Frederick Douglass, and acknowledging that they need these black men to fight, create the United States Colored Troops. So they would have fought earlier. The enslaved people of the South enlist as they can in informal fighting. But what you're seeing in 63 is the rapid deployment of black men who were wanting to wear the United States uniform. People remember the movie Glory.
Yes, indeed.
That's the story.
And for the slaves living in what was Augusta County in Virginia, life for them obviously was toiling. The brutality of plantation life.
Yeah, you know, Virginia's surprising to people. It's the largest slave state in 1860. You know, people might think that it's the Deep South, but Virginia sort of invented American slavery in the 17th century, figured out how you'd adapt English law to this institution. And so there's nearly 500,000 enslaved people in Virginia in 1860. The interesting thing, though, is Virginia can't grow cotton. It's not capable of it in its climate. It produces wheat, which just doesn't require as many enslaved people. So, unfortunately, one of the great products of Virginia was enslaved people to be ripped apart from their families and shipped to the Deep South. So Virginia liked to imagine it was a more genteel kind of slavery, but in some ways it was the worst because that was the place you were most likely to be separated from your family. And we tend to forget that in the decades before the Civil War, 1 million African Americans were moved inside the United States from the Eastern South to the Western South, far larger than the African slave trade as it concerned the United States. So Virginia, on one hand, has the idea that we're not really the Deep South, we're not really the Cotton Belt, but it has its own kinds of agonies.
Do we know how the freed blacks fighting for the Union, what they thought, how they reacted when they saw slavery?
Well, we do. As it turns out, this book draws on the largest single collection of letters from a set of African-American brothers, the Christie brothers. And just to give people a glimpse of how history works, this is all based on this big digital archive that we made. And the New York Times did a story about it, and a historian wrote and said, you know, you won't find him, but there's this huge cache of letters filed in the next county because the woman who was the sister of these brothers and the husband of one remarries after the war, after her first husband dies, and they live in the next county.
Oh, gosh.
And so I said, that's okay. I know where there are lots of 22-year-old eyes that will know how to read these and transcribe them. So it's remarkable. These are the men who go to fight with Robert Gulshaw, Denzel Washington, you know, in 1863 and throughout the war. And they are very eloquent. We know that what we are doing is that we are fighting for the rights of those who will follow us. And so here are people who have been prevented from fighting, who throw themselves into the war, and they have a clear sense that if they don't do this, it's not clear the United States will.
It'd be so fascinating to know how the enslaved people on plantations, what they thought when they saw black soldiers fighting for the Union.
Well, we've got a pretty good idea.
That's why you're here.
Yeah, well,
kind of a leading question there.
Yeah, they're thrilled. I mean, here's the thing to think about. So Augusta County in the Shenandoah Valley, it's close to the war for years. But unless you have the Union Army actually being there for long enough for you to escape with them, slavery gets worse during the war rather than better. Before, it's not that freedom just slowly arrives. It's that you're watching for it, and you might think about trying to make a break for it. And we do see lots of teenagers, you know, people who have the stamina are trying to escape to the Yankees. But otherwise, you have to wait until there's enough of them to come by that it's safe for you to do it. Yeah. And when you see black soldiers among that, it's an even more amazing sight. So I think we need to imagine what it's like to have been in perpetual bondage and with only the prospect of your children being in perpetual bondage, and suddenly an army appears in your midst that might be an ally.
This is a part of the war, I guess the second half of the war, and the pivotal battle is, of course, the Battle of Gettysburg. And until then, the war had largely been fought in the South. Lee decides to take it over this Mason-Dixon line and to fight the North in the North.
Yeah, and that's controversial at the time and still controversial today. The thing is that right before Gettysburg in the spring of 63, it looked as if the Confederacy was winning in Virginia, Chancellorsville and these other great victories. But the problem was that the army, both armies, had been in Virginia just devastating it for 2 years. We can imagine, if you can just pause for a minute, imagine what it's like when 10,000 people would show up in your neighborhood and eat everything there was, right? And so Lee's horses are starving. There's not enough resources. They need to get both armies out of Virginia. So part of it is, let's just move the focus of the war away. But part of it, too, is Lee writes his wife and says, I want to show the people of the North that they cannot count on Abraham Lincoln to protect them. We want to invade the North, show the world that the United States is not winning, that the Confederacy is. So the one reason people think of Gettysburg as pivotal is that because before that, the tide had seemed to be running the other way.
You quote someone, James Williams, writing to his father, I just wish you could see all the crops here. Pennsylvania, I never saw such wheat and corn in my life. And as you write here, this desperate search for food was something that was so important to the Confederacy.
Yeah, they come in with just enormous numbers of wagons that they're planning to fill with everything that they can take. Now, it's I don't know if it's amusing or not, but the Confederates had charged that the Yankees were just vandals coming in and stealing everything. So the Confederates say, we're not going to do that because we know the world's watching how we're doing this right now. So we bring in a printing press to print money to pay the Northerners for what we're taking from them. And everybody sees through that, but the idea is that we're more civilized. But the we forget, because we know how the battle comes after just a few weeks being there, the Confederate Army planned to be in Pennsylvania for as long as they could stay. Yeah. They hoped to come to Philadelphia and then to New York, certainly Harrisburg. And what they were planning to do was just get as much as they could, ship it back down through the Shenandoah Valley to help supply the army. And so they were stymied when they find they have to fight after only a couple of weeks in the North and when the Union Army tracks them down.
Well, I've been to Gettysburg. We were talking about this before right. going on the air. Several things struck me. One was just how big it was. I am no military historian, but just I was surprised at just the space that was covered there, obviously with all the famous hills and battles.
Yeah, one of the things I really emphasize is that a battle was far larger than the battlefield. If you think about the lines of supply, and these are days before any kind of transport other than railroads and foot and wagons and mules, no electric communication except the telegraph, which is very unlikely, unreliable. And so we actually need to pull the camera back. You could see the Battle of Gettysburg like a giant storm that swirls out from the center at Gettysburg, but comes all the way to Philadelphia, to Richmond. And then when you see the consequences of it and think about all the homes that lost someone there, yeah. It covers the nation. So I think that, you know, we want to understand the battlefield, but we need to understand that the battlefield is only the center of the storm.
We're almost up on a break here, but you do say that it has been described as pivotal, but the war went on for several years after that. How should we think of Gettysburg?
It's very important. We know it's pivotal later because it's in the middle of the war after the war ends, right? But
so we know this in hindsight.
Perhaps. Exactly. At the time, the Confederacy did not think that they had lost after this, and the North knew they had a great deal left to win. And as many men die after Gettysburg as die before. Oh. So we need to remember the war's not settled by the great victory at Gettysburg.
And something like, what, 50,000 people died
That's
at Gettysburg?
Right.
Just hard to fathom that. We're going to pick up on that. After this very short break, our guest is Edward Ayers. He's got a brand new book called The Thin Light of Freedom, The Civil War and Emancipation in the Heart of America. This battle, or I should say this history taking place in two counties, one in Pennsylvania, one in Virginia. You can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Edward Ayers. He's the co-host of a popular podcast called Backstory. He's also president of the Organization of American Historians and a professor at the University of Richmond. Again, he's got a new book called The Thin Light of Freedom. And we are talking about this very important time and place in the American Civil War, but we're also going to talk about how we are still wrestling with this history. And again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Let me correct myself. This is about Gettysburg, 50,000 people who died or were wounded.
Right, right.
But still, just in 3 days,
a
massive number of people. You quote a woman named Rachel Cormany, and she writes in her diary about the wounded, and this would be the Confederate wounded. They're taken in large four-horse wagons, wounds undressed, nothing to eat. Some are only about 4 miles from town, and those that are here are as dirty and lousy as they well can be. The condition of those poor rebels all along the Gettysburg, as far as they have come, yet as reportful as reported dreadful. I'm told they just beg people along the way to help them. Many have died, by the way. Just the level of carnage.
Yeah, we need a picture. This is a 17-mile-long wagon train of unsprung wagons with no straw even in them, escaping at night through the rain. And from the Confederate side, they tell the story. These men are begging to be killed, that it's just too painful. They've not been treated at all. And then you read the diaries of the Pennsylvanians who live along the way.
Yeah.
And one guy said he turned his light on his front porch. And then all of these Confederates just flowed to him and said, please give us water. And he had his pump in the front yard running all night long. These men would come up and put their arms or faces, whatever had been wounded, under the water just for a brief moment of relief. Yeah, I think, you know, we know the Civil War was bad.
Yes, we do.
We don't really feel it if you just look at the one moment of somebody being shot on the battlefield. You know, if you realize that this is dragging on for months and years afterwards, and you go, you know, here in Pennsylvania just seems like the land of milk and honey to these young men. And within 2 weeks, they're thrown in shallow graves along some roadside because the Confederates aren't going to stop to bury them. And so I spend more time actually talking about the consequences of the battle than I do about the battle itself, since people can read other books about what happened at Gettysburg. But imagine coming to that battlefield a week later and trying to make sense of it. So I think that Rachel Cormany, who's one of my favorite people in the diary, in the book, they're sympathetic. And yet those same men were trying to kill her husband at that battle. Mm-hmm. And that's what these Americans are wrestling with, that sort of the conflict between hatred and sentimentality is warring with them all through the war.
And there seemed to be some question about why would you leave your soldiers behind? But if you've got thousands of people who've been either killed or wounded, how do you rescue them?
Yeah, the Northerners really were very dismissive of the Confederates in this regard, probably because this is the only place that they're fighting in the North, right? And otherwise, you know, Rachel says, we hate to see the war come to Pennsylvania, but at least we'll be fighting surrounded by our allies. In the past, all our sons and brothers are fighting surrounded by enemies, and who knows what happens when they are wounded. And so the Pennsylvanians pride themselves on taking care of these abandoned Confederates, nursing them in their homes and churches. Mm-hmm. And so it's, like I said, there's this strange mixture of a recognition that these are fellow Americans. At the other hand, they've been trying to kill our own family. So it's tough.
It is tough. About a year later than William Sheridan's campaign in the same part of the United States, or what was then the Civil War, basically burning parts of Virginia.
Well, here's the thing, you know, is that this all happens before Sherman's march. So this is in 1864. So the Shenandoah Valley is remarkably beautiful, rich. It's also only about 100 miles from Richmond. And so it's the foodstuffs from that are going on this railroad down to Richmond. And the Northern Army can't get it. You know, Stonewall Jackson drives them away in 1862. And then in 1863, it uses the avenue of invasion of Gettysburg. And now 1864, it's still seeming to keep Robert E. Lee's army alive. So they finally decide, after several failed efforts to take the valley, that there's nothing to do except just build an overwhelmingly large army under Philip Sheridan, drive as far south in it as you can, and when you get to the area around the railroad, which happens to be Augusta County nearby, burn every crop, every barn, anything that could sustain the Confederate Army.
You know, I think today that might be considered a war crime.
Well, you know, and certainly people at the time, to Northern Democrats, we need to remember, were critical of almost everything the Republicans were doing through all this. And they said, do you think this is actually going to bring the war to an end? Are people going to forget that things that they'd spent lifetimes building were burned in a morning? What will the Confederates do when they have a chance? Well, as it turns out, we know, because they came up and burned Chambersburg to the ground. So there's so much devastation for so long in Virginia, the Confederates feel justified in doing whatever they can. Mm-hmm. And so the year after Gettysburg, following the same route that they followed for Gettysburg, the Confederates swoop into Chambersburg because they can. They demand $100,000, but the local bigwigs think they've outsmarted the Confederates by leaving with all the money and maybe coming to Philadelphia. And so, but the Confederate in charge says, my orders are to burn that if you don't give me the money. And so on a morning in July, they set fire to this town, and it is just gone in a morning.
In one morning, it's gone, yeah. Burned to the ground.
And it's the only northern place that's burned to the ground. So you have in the summer of 64, again, this is both before Sherman's march through Georgia, that the valley and these beautiful places in Pennsylvania and Virginia are the places where Americans are showing the limits of what they're willing to do to each other. You know, it's not clear that either Sheridan's burning of the valley or the Confederates' burning of Chambersburg did any good at all, except they were kind of theater. They were meant to say, you better give up because this is what we will do. This is what we can do. And we need to remember that in July of 64, you got the big event of the war coming up, which is the election of Abraham Lincoln. And this is a signal. Look, how many of your sons have you sacrificed, and yet we can still come into Pennsylvania and burn your towns. Don't you really want to think about electing somebody else president?
Let me get, looks like James from Kimberton to join us on Radio okay. Times, and then we will carry on with our story
right.
here. James, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. This is very much along the lines of my research, and I have been wondering where this a book like this has been, so very excited to hear about this. It's such dramatic stuff.
Great.
I'm calling from the Abolitionist and Underground Railroad stronghold of Kimberton, Pennsylvania, right next to Phoenixville. It's a fact that 75 miles away in Westchester, they could hear the Battle of Gettysburg going on, and it must have been an extremely creepy sound. My question is, what could the Confederate Army have done if they had won at Gettysburg? My thinking is that they were looking to find some of these very well-hated abolitionists and Underground Railroad workers. From my little village comes such abolition that the people of Chester County must have been very, very scared. Waiting to
sure.
see what happened.
Yeah, James. Yeah, I appreciate the call. Go ahead.
So we have a pretty good idea of what they would do because Thaddeus Stevens, the most radical Republican in Congress, had an ironworks in Franklin County, and they went to great effort to burn it to the ground and dismantle it. And it's also the case that the head of the Republican Party in Pennsylvania, Alexander McClure, lived in Chambersburg, and they came and burned his house and barn down in 1864, even though his wife pointed out, we took care of Confederate soldiers who were wounded, and here's a letter from them thanking us. So we don't care. You're on the side of the abolitionists. So you're exactly right. Not only did the Confederates come in and take very many African Americans and take them back into slavery, even if they had not been slaves before, even if they were not runaways, but they targeted people who seemed to embody this abolitionist crusade. So that's a great question.
James, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And people could hear the Battle of Gettysburg from miles and
100 miles. 100 miles. Because
the cannon?
And the cannon is so, you know, it was constant. It just kind of rose and fell. It'd give you some idea of what this was like. Just the cannon, there would be no break in it for hours and hours.
And let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Edward Ayers, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, talking about American history, the American Civil War. His new book is called The Thin Light of Freedom. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, talking about our history here on Radio Times. The war comes to an end, but as you write, in many ways the war continues.
Yeah, it's so many. What's the war over?
Yeah.
The war is over the future of the United States. And so the war decides really important things. It decides that secession has failed. It decides that slavery is over. But that's a big difference from knowing slavery is over and knowing what follows slavery. I think Americans tend to forget that our system of slavery was the largest and most powerful in the modern world and was growing stronger at the time of the Civil War. It was not fading away. It would not have gone away of its own accord, and it was adapting itself to the modern economy. And so it's not just an end of a story that was unfolded otherwise, but it's an abrupt reversal into it. It's also the case that when the war is over, there are still people bodies scattered all over the South, an area the size of continental Europe, in ditches and forgotten in people's gardens. And, you know, I tell the story of one father who has to move his son's remains three times. Uh-huh. You know, he has to go to the battlefield. They throw him under dirt at the battle. He has to go find him and then bring him home and then move him to the church. And it just I think we forget the physical legacy of the Civil War.
And maybe even how personal it was. I mean, in many ways, civil wars are almost stereotypically brother fighting brother, that kind of a thing.
Yeah. And, you know, the Upper South would have seen a great deal of that. But you also find in the North, you know, it's not just Confederate and Union. You have to figure out Northern Democrat and Northern Republican. So Samuel Cormany, the husband of Rachel Cormany that we talked about before, comes back home on a leave, and he says, it was great to see everybody, but his brothers seemed a little coppery to him. Now, that means copperhead, which means Southern sympathizer. So here you have this guy who's so, you know, appealing in his diary, and he's fighting with such idealism, you know, for freedom and union. And he comes home, his own brother is skeptical of the purpose of what he's doing.
I mean, white supremacy is alive and well at this time. And this feeling, as you write, the Democrats were concerned that armed black soldiers would, I guess, rise up against the country, and also this sense of superiority over slaves or former slaves.
Well, there was a fear among many white Northerners that, and we can understand why I would think that, that the formerly enslaved people would come north, you know, for opportunity and to get away from the people who'd held them in bondage. So you start seeing, even before the war is over, the Northern Democrats are race baiting left and right. And they are, you know, they invent a word, miscegenation, which means it's a fake word. It means race mixing. They claim the Republicans have made it, but they themselves wrote it and then promulgated it. So it's the very embodiment of fake news, you know, that they are saying, here's what our enemies believe in. And do you? And so the North and the White South is all white supremacists, right? But the North is also divided.
Talking about words, you talk about white Southerners creating several words. One was carpetbaggers, another scalawags, and the N-word as well.
Well, that word had been around a lot, but it is interesting how even today when we talk about Reconstruction, which in my opinion is the least well-understood moment in American history because it's so complicated. I'm sure we'll explain it all here in a few minutes.
I'm sure we will.
They'll clarify it completely. But in many ways, we talk today a lot about political correctness and the importance of language. And what you're referring to there is the way that the White South managed to brand people so that carpetbagger means that you're so poor that everything that you have will fit into a bag made out of a cheap piece of carpet. It would be like calling people the Jansporters today, right? Or scalawags is a puny runt pony. And so that's what it means if you're a white Southerner willing to support the Republicans. So if you're already called a carpetbagger and a scalawag, it's hard to say, no, I'm a native Southerner who believes in the union and freedom for black people. It's a lot easier for white people to call you a scalawag.
Absolutely. We will not do justice to Reconstruction,
right.
Make that clear to our listeners. But in many ways, from the Southern perspective, was it that the North becomes then this occupying force? And all that comes with that.
Yeah, I think, you know, talking about this around the country, I find that people, partly because they've seen Gone with the Wind, they think of Reconstruction as what happens immediately following the war. But there's a 2-year gap. And what happens is the White South is determined to do everything it can to resist everything that the North wants to do. And so there are riots, massacres in New Orleans and in Memphis. In every southern county, including Augusta County, there is all kinds of injustice and violence. There is economic brutality in which people are just prevented from making a living. And white Northerners who, not surprisingly, wanted their sons to come home. Okay, you've been fighting for 4 years. I don't really want to occupy the South. But it seems that the white South, under the leadership of Andrew Johnson, is so recalcitrant that there's nothing to do but to create radical Reconstruction, which says you've got to have all new constitutions for which black men are allowed to vote and to be delegates. And when you write those new constitutions that respect the 14th Amendment, then come back into the country. So this is the most radical sequence to slavery that we see in the hemisphere, which is that you go from a very strong, airtight system of bondage to a system in which formerly enslaved men are able to vote 2 years after mm-hmm. emancipation and to be delegates.
In fact, you say it wasn't until 1870 that Virginia was readmitted to the Union.
Yeah.
1870.
Yeah. Well, and man, you have to go through all of those different steps. And Virginia, you know, which is the, one of the last to join the Confederacy, ends up being the center of the Civil War. You know, they'd been strongly Unionist before, but now they're strongly Confederate, right? And so the big issue is, should the former Confederates be disfranchised? Because you raised arms against the United States, should you be allowed to vote or hold office? White South said, hey, good fight. It's done. We'll shake hands. Yes, we should be back in power. We're the good people. But the White North says, you killed our sons. Why would we put you right back into power to destroy the country again? What we think is that the people who had been the victims of slavery deserve political power. So from the white Southern point of view, it's two wrongs. Not only are they stripped of their power, but their former slaves are granted this power. So the struggle over Reconstruction is really over who is going to run the South.
That's a perfect segue to our discussion about how we wrestle with the Civil War today, and especially the debate, the argument, the fight over monuments. Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Again, Edward Ayers is our guest. We're talking about the American Civil War and his book, The Thin Light of Freedom, The Civil War and Emancipation in the Heart of America. And the book really takes place in two counties, one in Pennsylvania, one in Virginia, and what the war and Reconstruction was like for the people who lived it. And you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can also send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Much to talk about, especially after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. It's clear that some 150 years after the end of the Civil War, that there's still conflicts and violence over monuments and the Confederate flag, that the past is not past. And that's why it's so important to understand our history, which is why we're talking with Edward Ayers. He's a prize-winning author and historian of the Civil War. And again, his new book is called The Thin Light of Freedom. We're talking about this pivotal time and place during the war and also how we are wrestling with history today. And again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Are you surprised in 2017 that we are fighting over what to do about the monuments of the Civil War?
Well, you have to be surprised at the bloodshed and the vehemence. I first wrote about this 25 years ago and pointed out, hey, you know, these monuments were put up 25, 35, 45 years after the war. It's interesting to think about that, right? They don't just rise up out of the blood-soaked soil of the Confederacy. And so for the last 10 years, I live in Richmond, Virginia, and we've had something called the Future of Richmond's Past, where we have all kinds of conversations all around the city about this. And we commemorated not only the 150th anniversary of the Civil War, but of the Civil War and emancipation. The thing is, you can't separate those two stories. You know, the Civil War is often coded white, and emancipation is coded black, but they are the same thing, right? They're the same process. So this is the fundamental struggle at the heart of American history. And so I'm not really surprised that we're continuing to argue about it. And I don't think we will ever really stop talking about it. I hope we'll stop arguing the way that we are now.
But is it because the North, even though we didn't fight in this war, that we have a certain perspective on the Civil War, and the South does as well? And I know out of the Charlottesville demonstrations and fighting down there, we heard a lot of people saying, you know, my grandfather fought in this war. This is meaningful history to me, and you're trying to take it away from me by taking down this monument of Robert E. Lee.
That's right. And that people are I've been in many, many conversations all of this. And you know, people really just can't understand how people have the opposite opinion of the one that they have. And so there's a lot of charges of bad faith all around. I think that, you know, not surprisingly, as a historian of the Civil War, I think it'd be better if people knew more about the Civil War when they talk about it, because people are projecting onto the statues what they want them to say. You know, I think that in many ways, those statues, which were generally done by the 1920s, 1890s to 1920s, have seemed like just, I've called one place Victorian furniture in the middle of our cities, right? And they didn't say anything to most people. I find that young people have a very hard time of seeing why would we have these here at all,
right?
You know, because they were not raised with some veneration of Robert E. Lee, or frankly, not thinking very much about Ulysses Grant either. And so the war had sort of grown silent, and it's in that silence that people are able to certainly raise their voice against these statues.
Well, I'm thinking about Richmond in particular,
yep.
Which was, of course, the capital of the Confederacy. So much of the war was fought, as you have said, in and around this city. You've got this I have not been there, but I've read about this street lined
right.
with Confederate generals and people important to that, to the Confederacy. So what does Richmond do about this?
Well, I'm on the commission appointed by the mayor to wrestle with this. So what we're doing now is we're listening to everybody. And we're getting hundreds of wonderful, thoughtful suggestions about how we might move the city forward. I think that we need to be thinking creatively about other ways to remember what's going on. We think about the Vietnam War Memorial, right, and how eloquent that is. So everything doesn't have to be a statue of a man on horseback, right, to imagine. Now, Richmond's done a lot over the last few years to commemorate the role of slavery, the role of African-American people in making their own history. And there's an openness to telling a fuller story, but we have inherited Monument Avenue,
yes,
from the turn of the century. And the street itself really is a beautiful boulevard, and the Robert E. Lee statue from 1890 is an incredibly large and impressive statue. So we have more of it than anybody.
Yeah,
but we also have more of history than most people. I think what I'm struck with is that people recognize that you can't just tell one part of the story and call that history. You know, these monuments are not history. These are revisions of history. And it's time for us to think, okay, what would a fuller story look like? Richmond has particular responsibilities because it was also the center of the domestic slave trade. 400,000 people were sold out of Richmond to the Deep South. And there's work going on and money already dedicated to commemorating that slave trade, which you can't see anywhere else in the United States. So Richmond can be a leader on this. I'm also on the board of the American Civil War Museum, which is going to be the place where you can see the story of the Civil War that includes everybody from start to finish. You know, Richmond was the absolute center of the war, start to finish. It's where white Northerners came to fight and die, as well as white Southerners came to defend. And it's also where black Americans, it was the only time they actually had a chance to celebrate with Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln, the only place he's able to come to see the end of slavery is Richmond. So we're trying to represent all of that history. So I think that if people see it as a zero sum, that you have, mm-hmm, you know, the torchlight parades. The thing is that we've done a lot of research over 150 years. We have a really good idea of what people were saying and thinking. We need to respect the historical record in all its fullness.
Well, and just to pick up on something you said, and it's true, a lot of these monuments were put up at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. Why? And then we'll get some callers and we have some comments,
okay,
as well.
Well, there are two main reasons. One, the Civil War generation was dying off. And these are put up by the United Daughters of the Confederacy very often. And they are wanting to make sure that their sacrifices of their fathers are remembered. They knew that they were vilified by the North, and this was seen as a terrible cause that devastated the equivalent of 8 million Americans if the war occurred today, the same percentage. And this is acts of vindication. They are also symbols to the black people among whom these white people lived. Let's don't forget who runs this place,
exactly,
right?
And these
so
are public.
They're in public spaces, often paid for with public money, and they are symbols of white return to control after what they saw as the disaster of the Civil War and Reconstruction.
Let me see what Michael from Philadelphia has to say. Michael, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
I'm from the Workers' World Party. We were part of the group that pulled down the statue in Durham.
Right.
And we're dealing with that in the court system. But as a black man, as part of the Workers' World Party, which is a socialist party, I'm still a black man, and I don't see why we even have to have a conversation anymore about why black people or even indigenous people have to walk by these types of statues and see how great these repressive white men were and stuff. I mean, we still suffer today here in this city from all type of aggressive behavior by the police, which is a follow-up to the whole slavery thing. You know,
Michael, let me take your first point, because I think it's a really good one. And he's saying, from my perspective, and I'm not sure what exactly happened in Durham. It seems like you do know that. But from my perspective, from Michael's perspective, this is offensive. This has to go.
It is offensive, and I hear this many times from people of lots of different backgrounds who say, why in the world would a public space be dominated by something that was a war to perpetuate slavery and to create a separate nation based on slavery? And I think that many people are asking the same question. I think that, in Durham, the statue was just pulled down overnight. I think that in Richmond, where there are so many statues and a commitment to doing this through a sort of the electoral process, and the city council will be deciding what ultimately happens here, that is exactly the question. There's a city councilman in Richmond who's made the same argument. So I think that the position where we are now is that every position, including this one, needs to be articulated, and then the democratic process will figure out what it is that we do with this legacy that we have.
So in many ways, Richmond needs to decide for itself how it wants to deal with these monuments, how it wants to tell its
story.
Every
place will. Every American community embodies its own memory of the Civil War. And of the nation's complicity in slavery as well. I think that the trick is, can we use this moment to have a deeper understanding of all the struggles at the heart of American history rather than trying to push them aside? Mm-hmm. So this is a profound question. I respect the question. As you think about what's possible legally, what's possible politically, that's where the complications come in.
Michael, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And you can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. Did I read correctly that you want there to be a national holiday to commemorate emancipation?
Yeah, it is amazing that there is no national acknowledgement, the most important thing that's ever happened in this country, which is the end of perpetual bondage for 4 million people. Now, there are holidays, Juneteenth and other holidays that African-American people themselves and their allies celebrate, and that's great too. It strikes me, though, it would be an important symbol as a part of the same conversation we're having now for the country as a whole to acknowledge that, well, we can have a day for things that seem less important than this. It's a kind of a monument itself, a day that we would all stop and reflect about 250 years of slavery and then another 100 years of segregation and the current injustice and inequalities that we have. It would be good for the country to reflect on this.
Do you think that will happen?
You know, one thing about history, the only thing you know is going to happen is what nobody knows is going to happen.
Right, exactly. In fact, one of the things you say in the book, and it bears repeating, which is just history is not this static thing. Yes, it happened in the past. These are the facts of history, but our interpretation, our understanding of history goes forever.
Well, as we see in the recent controversy about the statues, is that people who had not thought very much about the Civil War are now and thinking about how did we come to this moment. So I think that some people see the current controversy as a dysfunction. I think that's a necessary stage for us to go through. It's there's no way through this history except through it. We tried tiptoeing around it for a long time. We tried just ignoring it and pasting things up, but it's that hidden history that comes back and gets you. So nobody would wish for what happened in Charlottesville, but the conversation as a whole, I think, is a necessary thing for the United States to have.
Now, thinking about Gettysburg, and I do recommend that people go. It's just there's something about being there and walking yep. those fields and seeing everything, including the markers. And there's a part of Gettysburg where states from the North and the South were able to put up monuments, essentially, to the soldiers who fought and died at Gettysburg. And what struck me was, broadly speaking, that the statues, the monuments from the South were more flamboyant than the ones from the North. The North seemed more modest, more sort of, all I can say is sort of less flamboyant. I don't know if I'm making that up, but that was the impression that I got, that there was some kind of implicit message coming from both sides of that war.
Well, the most controversial statue in Richmond is that of Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy. And there is a giant column, and on the top of it, a goddess, and it's the goddess of vindication. Okay, so I think that's what a lot you're seeing in these statues mm-hmm. is there's a sense of we were not wrong. We were fighting for home, for honor, dignity. We were not fighting for slavery. And so I think there is a sort of an extra, it's not really commemorating men who died in a good cause. Mm-hmm. It's trying to argue that the cause was worthy in the first place.
Let me read a tweet that says, the irony is that Lee, after the war, wanted no statues or monuments to remind us, but a return to being united. We have no statues of General Arnold, I guess that would be Benedict Arnold, or other traitors to the American cause. Why to Confederate rebels?
Yeah, it's a profound question. And I think that, you know, in my book, there's a quote when Lee dies in 1870. And so he does not live into the era when the monuments really become popular. So we don't know what he might have said later on. But in the immediate aftermath of the war, when it's occupied by the United States Army, the idea of putting up a Confederate monument does seem like a bad idea. But when he dies, this Pennsylvania paper from Chambersburg says, even though other papers around the country are bordering their pages in black, he says, no, we should just let him lie, because the things that he did, he could have ended the war in 1864, but he was one who dragged it out and led to the deaths of so many people. And he was the one that if he had chosen not to go with the Confederacy in the first place, it could have played a major role. So as early as 1870, there are people in the North who are all over any fantasy of Robert E. Lee. It grows over time as the memory of the war itself fades. It's like the White South is given this runner-up prize. Okay, you can venerate these generals. You lost everything else. But in the process of venerating the generals, the enormous stakes of the war tended to be forgotten.
Almost out of time here. Did the South then bring about the end of slavery?
Yeah, the fact is that the only way that the largest, most powerful system of slavery in the modern world could possibly have been destroyed in 5 years was if the South stepped out from underneath the constitutional protections that it had. Abraham Lincoln said, I have no right to touch slavery where it exists. Our goal is to hem it in so that it will die of its own weight. That should happen in about five generations.
Which so, would have taken us into the
1960, right? Yeah. So the idea, though, is that the South was so confident, shall we say, that it was going to dominate the North, and that the North would back down. They don't necessarily know they're going to fight a war. They think if they're big enough and strong enough, central to the world economy, that the United States will back down. I think it's a lesson to all of us, is that the United States in many ways talked itself into a war. There was sort of boasting on both sides, drawing of lines, but the White South did the only thing that could possibly have triggered the immediate emancipation of slaves, which was to secede. And then their resistance to what had been won in the war led to Reconstruction and the 14th and 15th Amendments. So there are stories here still to learn.
That was historian Edward Ayers discussing his book, The Thin Light of Freedom, The Civil War and Emancipation in the Heart of America. We hope you enjoyed the interview and that you are enjoying your 4th of July. The Radio Times producers are Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for joining us.